And our guest this hour, Jeff Finn. We, of course, just talked about his incredible documentary that he did with his wife, Jess, Strange Septembers. We're going to talk with him about a production he's working on now called Before the End, Searching for Jim Morrison. I guess you know what that's all about. We'll talk with him about that, too, when we come right back. And welcome back to Coast, Jeff Finn with us. We're going to get to your calls. But, Jeff, I want to talk with you a little bit about the documentary you're working on, Before the End. You would get a kick out of this, and I'm going to make this available to you if you're still working on your documentary. But we interviewed two of the three last remaining Doors at the time a few years ago, Robbie Krieger and Ray Manzarek. They were in our studio. And, of course, Ray died of liver cancer about a year and a half later. We may have been the last ones to interview both of them together. John Densmore, the drummer, of course, wasn't there. But Krieger and Manzarek were in the studio. Great guys. We talked about whether Morrison was alive or not. But you can use a portion of that if you want. Just work it out with Tom, and we'll get it to you.
Oh, right on. Thank you so much. I
and no charge.
Or maybe we'll swap a squatty potty, perhaps.
Great voices, by the way, in that, huh? They've got them down to a science. tell me a little bit about the documentary then, Before the End.
Well, I'd like to, you know, think that the title is quite descriptive and works on a number of levels. Initially, I started out, you know, this was coming off of Strange Septembers, and as I said earlier, Jess and I now have 5 years of experience and knowledge and research, and you know, we've upgraded in terms of professional gear and equipment and the whole thing. So we love Strange Septembers. It's our baby, our firstborn, but you know, Before the End is a whole different animal and a huge undertaking. And it started out, I initially called it Before the End, Jim Morrison Comes of Age, because it was going to be not specific, but largely about Jim Morrison's formative years and mm-hmm. coming of age, if you will. And this is a period in his life that is often glossed over. Books, you know, documentaries, Oliver Stone's film, you know, with all due respect to Oliver Stone, I mean, it was a flash on the screen, you know. And these are his formative years. I mean, it's a hugely important era in anyone's life. And so I really wanted to delve into that. You know, who was Jim Morrison really? Beyond the quote-unquote Lizard King, the trademarked brand, you know, the rock star, the rock god, the sex, drugs, and rock and roll. I feel that's really just sort of been done to death, no pun intended, you know, shoved down our throats for nearly 50 years now. So I wanted to delve into the human being, you know, not the rock star. I wanted to get into who is the real guy and why. Why did he end up that way? How, you know? And so, again, like Strange Septembers, the film began to morph and evolve to my delight. And I have a personal, you know, huge interest in this case. And so Jess, you know, went on board as a co-producer and let me take the reins as the sole director on this one. And I've really just been living it for almost 4 years now. And we're due, we're scheduled, hopefully, if all goes according to plan, to release the film later this year. There have been a number of delays, and I know the fans are chomping at the bit because I hear from them daily, and I appreciate it. Yeah, we're really, really digging into who Morrison was as a real person and why.
And you're convinced he's dead, as Krieger and Manzarek were convinced.
Well, that's the 50... I was going to say $50,000. Maybe that's the $50 trillion question. I don't know. It's all subjective, as yeah. everything is.
They think he's dead, but it was an interesting possibility.
I'll say this. Again, with all due respect to the surviving Doors, particularly Ray, who has passed on recently.
Yeah.
I believe that they had to maintain that. Let's just say that. And again, I respect anyone's opinion.
Interesting.
You know, it's not a contest here. People get so up in arms.
Are you telling us where the documentary is going to lead?
I can say, you know, first of all, I'm just sort of taking things X amount of notches deeper. You know, there's so much silly hinting and passive aggressive, you know, twitching going on about Jim Morrison all these decades. Again, and with all due respect to the books and documentaries and films. everyone sort of hints at this and hints at that and dances around this and dances around that. And I wanted to just cut the BS and cut to the chase and be like, you know, we're only on this ball of dirt for so long, so let's get to it, you know? I mean, what are we waiting for? And it's like John Densmore said in 1980, I believe, how much money do we really need? You know, he was in a documentary and he pointed around his living room and said, how much money do you really need? It doesn't matter after a while, implying
right.
that they were jillionaires, you know, then. And so I feel there's, you know, there's a brand to be protected. And again, that's, I respect that, you know, but I hope that those people can respect that we're working in a parallel path.
They got tired of touring because of Morrison's antics, I guess, didn't they?
Yes, that's fair. But to be fair, Jim had his reasons for also being tired of their behaviors. So it goes both ways. And, you know, I can say this certainly that I've learned, and I've spoken now to over 600 people who are connected to Jim, from friends, lovers, high school classmates, elementary school classmates, college film school classmates, coworkers, you name it. I mean, I got to 150, I think, on Strange Septembers. I'm now closing in on 700 people connected to Before the End, searching for Jim Morrison. So I worked my ass off, if I do say so. And I'd like to believe it's going to show in this film. You know, we're trying to present a real human portrait here of who this guy was and what his motivations were. And I can say this, you know, at the risk of giving away, you know, this or that, I absolutely believe, you know, whether Jim faked his death in 1971, July 3rd of 71, or he died, as has been reported, quote unquote, officially.
In France, right?
In France, in Paris, France. And I'll get to that for the two people on the planet who don't know the story. I believe that he was living a role. He was acting out a role, a performance piece that he drafted himself, that he created for himself. And it began long before July of 65, when the Doors apparently formed on Venice Beach. This is something that goes back to his high school years. And again, I'm just, you know, I'm not digging up anything brutally new, although I do have, well, the things I do have are brutally new and I think quite shocking. But I will say that I've interviewed high school classmates of his who have nothing to gain because I sought them out. They did not seek me out looking for a buck or for exposure.
Right. You found them.
I found them. I dug so deep that I found them and unearthed them and asked them to talk. And they told me that Morrison was telling them at the age of 17, when he was a senior in high school at George Washington High School in Alexandria, Virginia, that he was going to disappear at one point and reemerge in an anonymous life. And he was obsessed with Arthur Rimbaud, the poet, who did, in fact, fake his death, as crazy as it sounds.
Now, that's an interesting twist.
In real life. So that's just one facet of the film. I mean, we're working on multiple levels here, from the day Jim was born to the day...
How old would he be today, if he were alive?
Oh, he would be now 70... What would he be? 72 years old?
Not too bad.
He was born the day John Lennon... was assassinated December 8, 1943. So, you know, again, no one can prove
Lennon wasn't assassinated in 43.
No, forgive me. December 8, 1980 was when John Lennon was assassinated.
Right.
But Jim was born December 8, 1943. They share that same infamous day for very different reasons.
Okay.
Thank you for pointing that out.
Yeah.
But I can tell you that... you know, it's an honor for me to go there because I was a huge Morrison fan. I've studied him, his life informally, you know, at different points in my life, beginning in 1985 when I read No One Here Gets Out Alive by Jerry Hopkins and Danny Sugarman. And that book has taken a lot of heat through the years, and I believe rightfully so in some respects and some not. You know, it's filled with, I think, unequal parts truth and fabrications, distortions, and maybe flat-out lies. But it also has a brutal truth to it, and I believe that for better or worse, they laid the blueprint, just as John Fuller did for the Hill case and the Exeter case. No One Here Gets Out Alive.
Well, we had fun with Krieger and Manzarek, and And Ray took a while to warm up to. When I was with him before the show started, and I was talking to him in one of our little studios while he was waiting and Robbie was waiting, he was kind of cold. And, you know, I went back to Tom and said, "Boy, Tom, this is going to be a tough interview. He's not opening up." And Tom said, "Well, just keep talking to him. He'll loosen up." And he did. And he turned out to be just a wonderful guy.
Oh, fantastic.
Just a super guy. But in the beginning, just getting to know him, he was, you know, pretty reserved. And then, but once he got going and once he felt comfortable with you, he really, he turned it on. And
you know, it's fascinating. I got as far as emailing Ray via his personal email, which was given to me, forwarded to me, actually. I didn't even ask for it. By a UCLA film school classmate of Jim Morrison's and Ray Manzarek's. And so I emailed him a couple of times and never heard back. And I was saddened, you know, to hear that he maybe, I don't know, 8 months after that, he had passed away.
He must have had the cancer when we were interviewing him.
And he didn't tell us.
He didn't say anything to us.
Maybe that's why he was a bit reserved, you know.
Initially, yeah.
In that sense alone. So now it's interesting, again, you know, I've encountered 600 people, over 600, well over that at this point. And for the most part, everyone's been, just like Strange Septembers, everyone has been very forthcoming and actually willing to work with me, and I've been very grateful for that. Unfortunately, there's a small but vital section of people I won't name at this point, but they were, I got word that they had been informed to not work with us. And, you know, that is what it is. You take it for what it
is. Why is that? Because they were afraid of your conclusion?
I think so. I mean, again, you know, teach their own with all due respect, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, yeah, I mean, I feel that there's a myth. There's a myth to nurture, you know, and to prod along through the decades to reach a new generation of high school and college kids. And that myth is the Lizard King. And that's not to say that that wasn't an aspect of Jim, you know, who he was, but there was so much more to this guy, not to mention his intelligence.
Which is also interesting, is he would have been aware of the, you know, 27 Club, right? All those incredible talents that died at the age of 27. And that's the age that he apparently checked out one way or another.
Yes, yes. If you believe it, you know, it's like the Hill case. Do you believe it? You know, now the amazing thing about Jim Morrison, in my opinion, you know, there were allegedly five people there on July 3rd, 1971, in Paris, France, where he supposedly died of a heart attack.
He was like in a bathtub or something.
In a bathtub, right? Yes. Others believe he died in a club near his Paris flat called the Rock and Roll Circus. You know, there are numerous quote-unquote official...
Yeah, or OD'd or something.
Yes. And it goes on and on, and everyone has their take on it, and people get very... I mean, I've had friends of Morrison screaming in my face, "He's dead! You need to let it go!" And I said, "Well, what are you covering up for? You know, I mean, can't you respect that I have an open mind about it? I mean, I respect, you know, your take. So why can't you respect mine? You have a closed mind. I have an open mind. You know."
Did he have brothers and sisters?
He did. He had a brother, a younger brother named Andy, Andy Morrison, and a younger sister named Ann Morrison. And
I assume they're still living.
And right. I've interviewed Andy for the film. And just like Strange Septembers, where we had a number of exclusive interviews, including Lieutenant Alan Brandt of the Air Force, I'm very, very happy to say that we have Andy Morrison in his first official interview.
Let me ask you this directly. Did the brother, Andy, ever say that he got a call from Jim Morrison after the fact?
That's the other $50 trillion question, isn't it, George?
Is it in your documentary?
I will say this. I was astounded. I was astounded. I thought, you know, when I built up to that question, that Andy might say something like, you know, he had me over to his house. He let me sleep over at his house. He was such a nice guy. I thought he was going to say, "Get out of my living room," et cetera. You know, when I went there, he said, "I've heard those rumors, obviously, 1,000 times, 1,000,000 times, you know, whatever he said." He said, "But I will say this. He was absolutely capable of it." So for his own brother to say that it wouldn't surprise him at all. Jim was completely capable of it because he was so vastly interested in Rambeau, mm-hmm. having faked his death and pulled a Houdini, as I say. and countless other people I interviewed that, again, I really thought, asking the question, do you believe Jim Morrison faked his death, or do you believe Jim Morrison was capable of it? You know, so many of them said, without blinking, I believe he did it. I absolutely believe he did
it. I just couldn't do that. I couldn't abandon my family, my kids, my grandkids, my friends. I just couldn't do it. I couldn't just fall off the map and disappear like that.
I couldn't either, but that's where it gets very interesting, and that's where those sort of fine line gray scale shadings come into play, and that's something that you'll just have to, you know, the listeners will have to wait for before the end, or BTE as we call it, to come out, because there's just so much. It's so nuanced. I really can't do it justice here, but again, this is a guy.
Is Elvis dead?
I believe Elvis is dead, yes.
He's dead.
Okay. There are only two people, I believe, who may have faked their death, and that's Jim Morrison and Andy Kaufman in terms of celebrities, but that's neither here nor there.
Kaufman,
I will
say
this.
So. That, okay, that's an interesting
thing. Jim Morrison, first of all, he set the archetype. If you're talking in terms of rock and roll, his work with the Doors, I mean, he was a pioneer in that field. It's just incredible. And this, I should point out, this is not a Doors documentary. I mean, we cover the Doors.
Right, but it's about Morrison.
But this is specifically about Jim Morrison, from birth to alleged death.
Was he a talented kid?
He was. He was highly, highly talented. And that's another thing. He's thought of as this stoner, you know, this drug addict and heroin junkie, and all these urban legends and myths have risen up around him. And as I say, you know, in the tagline for the film, you know, one man, countless myths, and in between lies the truth. So what is it? You know, and we don't claim to have it definitively, because again, no one can prove anything definitively. You know, his friends who screamed in my face, I said, were you there in Paris on July 3rd, 1971? And they had to say, no. So I said, then how can you tell me definitively what happened?
Interesting. Jeff, who got the estate?
Oh, that is a whole other can of proverbial worms. That gets very convoluted, and I would invite any of your listeners to Google that one. This is something that spreads out between Doors management, current Doors management, you know, who was taken over for Danny Sugarman.
Did Andy Morrison get it?
Yes. It gets very involved in terms of who represents Jim personally and who represents him professionally, and then also who represents the band as a business entity.
It would be interesting to see if money is still being taken by an entity for Morrison.
Exactly.
Somewhere.
And this is what I brought up just a few minutes ago. And again, forgive my excitement for sort of going across the radar here. I'm just thrilled to be on the show because I'm a fan, and I appreciate you having me on. But I will say this, you know, Jim, he broke the mold. He set the rock star frontman archetype. And again, that's its own thing.
He may be listening to you right now, maybe. But, maybe he'll call in. Morrison, call in.
This is a guy who was making millions, you know, millions of dollars in 1960s, late 1960s economy.
Oh, I bet his library is worth a fortune today.
Oh, it's incredible. And all the time he was making, you know, just from Light My Fire alone, which defined the Summer of Love and A Generation, you know, as a number one hit, not to mention the countless other hits and albums they released. This is a guy who was living in a $10 a night motel on the corner of La Cienega and Santa Monica Boulevard in West Hollywood, California.
I know it well. Not the hotel, but the spot. We'll be back, Jeff, and we will take calls next on Coast to Coast AM. Well, next hour, John Greenwald joins us as we talk about his work, The Black Vault, Secret UFO Stories. When we come back with Jeff Finn, we'll take your calls now about the Barney and Betty Hill case and also his new documentary he's working on, The Life of Jim Morrison. Hey, so as I mentioned, just came back from Cincinnati at the Victory of Life event. Had a great time. Those folks in Cincinnati love their Reds, but they're great people, and we had a good time. But another event coming up, that's June 18th, Saturday, in St. Louis, folks. Jam the Lindenwood University Theater. Let's do it, because it fills, I'm told, about 1,000-plus people. I've got Stanton Friedman. He's going to be one of the special guests. Tickets are on sale right now at 971talk.com. That's the website of our great affiliate here, 971talk.com. Okay, welcome back to Coast to Coast. Jeff Finn with us. We're going to take some calls now. Jeffrey, you ready?
I am. Thank you.
Let's go. Let's pick it up with the Jim in Pennsylvania, east of the Rockies. Jim, welcome to the program.
Hi, George, and hi, Jim.
Hi there.
I had some information which you may or may not be aware of. I am a personal friend of J. Allen Hynek.
And oh, wow.
I've worked with Stan Friedman at the Astronuclear Lab in Pittsburgh. And, George, I was also a friend of Jim White. I think I talked to you one night on the radio about that.
Yeah, you sure did.
There was a document that was found on the teletype at Pease Air Force Base, which is near where the Betty and Barney Hill case took place. And at the time that the Betty and Barney Hill case apparently happened, the Pease Air Force Base perimeter radar tracked an object taking off from the area and flying around the Air Force Base. The teletype was left on the Air Force Base computer or typewriter in the morning, and I got a copy of it from Dr. Hynek. And I don't know if you've seen this or not, but I'm sure that UFO center probably has copies, and Stan may also have a copy of it.
That's fantastic. I know for a fact that having interviewed Lieutenant Alan Brandt, who was the a public relations officer for the Air Force at Pease Air Force Base at the time of both cases, he said that, you know, his term was the Air Force went on high alert during specifically the Exeter case. Now, as far as the Hill case, I would be fascinated to have that information. Can you share it with us? Do you have it now?
I have it right here. We moved a few months ago, and it's stored in a place in Pittsburgh. I don't have it here. It might take me a couple months to get to it, but I do have it, and I'd be glad to send a copy either to you or George, and then he can forward it to you.
Oh, absolutely. Definitely.
To get it right away. I presume that the Center for UFO Studies would probably have a copy, and Stan may have a copy. I just don't know that for sure.
If anyone has it, I'm sure Stan does.
Yeah. Okay, well, that's just one to pass that along. I've enjoyed your show, and I want to see this documentary you're putting out.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
It's amazing. You know what? You do a talk show, and you get information like this, Jeff, just like that.
Oh, it's fantastic. Just wonderful.
Next up, we go to Robert in Baltimore, Maryland. Hello, Robert. Good morning.
Hello, George and Jeff. Jeff, the big issue for you is going to be the ability to get around the disclosure problem that we have now. It's getting distribution of your movie to the general population and to getting exposure of it. And I wanted to ask, George, have you had anyone threaten you about the subject matter that you put on Coast to Coast? I've noticed.
No, not yet, Robert. I've not been approached to ever cancel a story, nor have I ever been threatened if I was going to go with a story.
That's wonderful, because, you know, CBS on their 60 Minutes, they had a show they were going to put on. They were told they'd better not do it. And, of course, Bill Burns has been told that after his writing down the airplane numbers that he saw at the airport, he was told to back off. They didn't like that. And there's a number of radio stations that had programs they were going to put on. It's really, there's pressure being put on by these people who are called the men in black sometimes, but they are really, I'd like to know why the men in black can't be reported to the police, because they're not part of the regular military system that we as citizens have voted in. You know, the government that we have does not connect with those men in black, and apparently they are outside of the working relationship with our government, and they therefore should be reported and maybe tracked down, because they do tend to stop people who are going to put on this information.
They probably have diplomatic immunity, Robert, somehow.
I was going to tell you, Robert, I was pleased to say that in the making of Strange Septembers, the Hill abduction and the Exeter encounter, my documentary film I co-directed with my wife, Jess, we were, you know, very happy to have everyone be very cooperative, from the interviewees to my, you know, research consultants. Even Lieutenant Alan Brandt, who I mentioned just a while ago, he was a key toggle point between the Hill case and the Exeter case. And we were happy to bring forth new information with him First time he gave an exclusive interview. So everyone was very helpful. I was going to mention this before the interview was done. I'll say it right now. Near the very end of filming on Strange Septembers, I had someone contact me on my cell phone and like out of a movie, say to me in some muffled voice, "You're getting close," and then hang up on me. I assumed it was, you know, one of my friends playing a good-natured prank on me. They said they did not. Huh. And then within a week, about a week after that, I had another source, I don't know if it was the same, contact me, as I've called them, you know, for lack of a much less dramatic term, a deep throat type source, you know, Watergate reference. They gave me brand new information about the Exeter case, which is in our film, in a nutshell, that Norman Muscarello experienced missing time, and that Eugene Bertrand, the first police officer on the scene in Exeter, Kensington, New Hampshire specifically, that he had, quote, an object removed from his brain. Now, Bertrand later died of brain cancer, that is true, in the 90s. You know, and again, I can't prove it one way or the other, but I will say this. The anonymous source requested anonymity, and I knew that they were reputable, and then some, so I went with it, you know, but I'm... my wife and I are leaving, you know, the viewers to draw their own conclusions. We can't, you know, confirm or deny anything. We can't prove anything. But, you know, everyone is very helpful, even this you know, shadowy source at the end there. Hmm. So who knows?
Jeff, what do you think of the Roswell, New Mexico case?
I mean, it's just incredible. I think it's, and again, credible. it's the mothership, pun definitely intended. You know, the granddaddy, whatever you want to call it, it's ground zero for ufology in the postmodern era. And, you know, Stan Friedman has just done amazing, made an amazing effort on that. I think even his detractors would agree with that. You know, he put it on the map after it had been stored away. And all these deathbed confessions coming out in the last decade or so. I personally, you know, again, I can't prove anything. But I'm definitely leaning more towards belief than disbelief because there's just so much information. And, you know, if we're the best that humanity can, or that the universe can produce, you know, humanity, then I think it's really rather sad with our constant wars and you know, infighting and narcissism and just on and on. So I always say that's the, you know, the mothership of the cases, and then I refer to Exeter and the hills as the Twin Peaks of ufology. So the three of the cases are just at the top for me in terms of credibility. I mean, just absolutely plausible. And again, you know, with all due respect to debunkers, they will always fly right alongside the believers or the more open-minded. But I feel personally that, you know, they're hiding behind fear, that, you know, a fear that's masquerading as a pedantic rhetoric, you know. So again, teach their own, but I just, there has to be more. You do the numbers among the stars. I mean, it's a fifth grader could work it out for you on a blackboard, you know. I mean, the mathematical possibilities are just vast.
Next up, we have first time caller Ricky in Baytown, Texas. Good morning, Ricky. Go ahead.
Yes, I was wondering if anyone has actually thought about or knew that during the same time period in which they were doing the MK Ultra plan, there were some scientists experimenting with what they referred to as mind control. And I don't have my notes with me, but there was a plan that was discussed among those scientists where they wanted to see if they could wipe someone's mind and eliminate memories, and they thought the best way to try to do this was to replace a memory. And the only way to really see if the experiment was successful was they needed to come up with something that was completely outlandish to replace the memory with. And somebody thought, well, what about we just have them think they were kidnapped by an alien? And I figured with cases like that out there, if they do exist, maybe they could have been put in place just to discourage people from researching UFOs, because some of the cases would be just nothing but wild goose chases.
Another type of implant, a mind implant. Yeah, I find it fascinating, like all of it. I mean, it's, you know, as a researcher, I look at all of it and try to look at it from every possible angle, vantage point. I will say that, you know, MK Ultra did not come deep into play in Strange Septembers. I was actually surprised by that, although my, again, for lack of a better term, my deep throat source mentioned a connection to MK Ultra with regards to the Hills. And so this was at the very end of filming. But I do find it fascinating, as George and I have been discussing with specific regard to Dr. Benjamin Simon and the Betty and Barney Hill case. Again, Simon was the professional hypnotherapist who had worked with veterans of World War II and Korea in terms of post-traumatic stress disorder. So he was highly, highly respected in this field. I find it fascinating, I'll just finish up with that, that he was hypnotizing the Hills as part of their, you know, regression therapy. And then the Hills themselves believe they were hypnotized by the humanoid or extraterrestrial beings. So you have hypnosis on both ends of the case.
We go to Las Vegas now. Rick is with us, west of the Rockies. Hey, Rick.
How you doing, George? Jim, what's up, guys?
All is good. Jeff.
Jeff, yeah.
George and Jeff.
George and Jeff, I'm sorry.
That's okay.
No problem.
I'm a cab driver here in Vegas, George, and I tell you, I was a big, big Doors fan. And I got a story from the early 80s where I had a job prior to computers where I used microfiche, if you remember that.
I remember that stuff.
I remembered it as well.
Yeah, I was able to look up names and addresses of people who had fires. We were fire insurance adjusters, so I could look up Johnny Carson, anybody.
Wow.
Well, one day, because I was a huge Doors fan, I looked up and found Ray Manzarek. Yeah, and in Hollywood, it had his physical address. These were county records. So the old school way, I penned him a letter. And at the very end of the letter, I said, you know, if you feel like it, give me a call. Here's my phone number. And I sent it off. And about 2 weeks later, I'm downstairs and I'm swimming in the pool and my brother's upstairs in my apartment. The phone rings. He answers the phone. He comes out to the railing and he goes, Rick, phone call. And I go, yeah, who is it? He says, it's Ray Manzarek of the Doors. And I said, oh, I said, you got to be. I jumped out of the pool, ran upstairs, and I talked to him for probably 2 hours.
How cool.
Okay. Now, get this. A couple of days later was the 20th anniversary of Light My Fire being number one on the charts. And he was on Rockline in L.A. at the time. And he did a show. I actually got through. I called in. He remembered who I was. I told him I was the guy that called him. And the very last thing I said to him, of course, you know, we talked about Jim, et cetera.
Yeah.
And I said, hey, if you ever see Jim, tell him I said hello. And he said, I will.
I like that. Hey, Rick, thanks. That's a great story.
Thank you, man.
You're welcome, man. I love it. Love your show, George. Keep it up, buddy.
Thanks, Rick. That is a neat. Well, I'm beginning to think, Jeffrey, that your conclusions might be that Jim Morrison is still around somewhere.
I can tell you, you know, again, that information has been out there in pieces for years, and I'm just trying to collate everything into some concise point of view and take it further. You know, just really dig as deep as I can to get to the truest truth.
I wonder what he thinks of music today.
I mean, there there's so many alleged, you know, quote unquote facts, and we're talking about, you know, 45 years of rumor. You know, it'll be 45 years he allegedly died this July 3rd. There's so much rumor and urban legend and disinformation and just outright lies.
He came back as Lady Gaga, didn't he?
Let's hope not. But that's with all due respect to Lady Gaga. But, you know, I think it's time to really take on these myths, you know, and the death rumors are the biggest part of that. But also to go even deeper, you know, how, whether he died that day or not, what drove him to live such a unique life? And who was the guy who wrote these amazing poems and songs, especially the songs with no prior musical experience? I mean, it's like he came out of the blue. Then you get into, you know, if you want to talk conspiracy angles, his father, being the youngest admiral in the history of the Navy at that point, His father's out there. You know, again, this has been covered, but we're digging even deeper. You know, his father's fighting in Vietnam while Jim is on stage
protesting,
screaming against the war in songs like The Unknown Soldier, you know. So you can't write this stuff. And I believe Oliver Stone is, you know, 50 times the filmmaker I am. I mean, he's vastly talented, but, you know, he does Hollywood movies, and we're doing independent, truly gritty, you know, punk rock documentaries here. And on the fly, and you know, again, we've stepped up our game with Before the End. It's a whole other animal in terms of production quality, but we're really trying to keep it, you know, minimalist and to the point. And so, again, with due respect to Stone, I don't feel he put his best foot forward with his film about the Doors, because it just sort of reinforced all the myths. Just as the recent documentary, When You're Strange, a film about the Doors that came out about 5 years ago. Again, very well made, in my opinion. Tom DiCello is a very talented guy, but, you know, I just feel it reinforced Jim Morrison, the rock star myth.
Wasn't there another myth of a rock star, Eddie and the Cruisers?
Yes.
That he took off and disappeared too?
Yeah, I've actually met a guy who was in production on that film. We're talking, you know, 30 years ago already on that, you know, and I think it was 85 or so. And, you know, in a nutshell, that film, as he told me, was a sort of a hybrid nod to Jim, you know, the legend of Jim faking his death. And then, of course, Springsteen, who was, you know, the king at that point. So sort of the Springsteen rock vibe meets Jim Morrison's, you know, conspiracy leanings, if you will.
Well, I look forward to this. Now, when is this one done?
We are deep into post-production now. Again, hoping to release the film later in the year. That is the plan, and I gratefully send a shout-out to all the, as I call them, the BTE, Before the End, BTE faithful on our Facebook page and our Kickstarter and Twitter, and just everyone who's followed us and been so patient with their support and enthusiasm. Because it's just been delay upon delay, but that's often the case in a film that's truly independent, you know, in terms of its operation.
Super. Jeff, let's get together when I come back to L.A. in a few weeks, okay?
I would love it, George, and I thank you for having me on so much.
Jeff Fenn, two documentaries, one called Strange Septembers, the other that he's working on, Before the End, Searching for Jim Morrison. I'm George Norrie. We're going to go into the Black Vaults of UFOs next on Coast to Coast AM.